Last case of the afternoon is case number 53376, Philip Dreyfus v. State of Nevada. Are you ready to proceed?
Good afternoon, Justice Seda, Justice Cherry, Justice Gibbons. My name is Dwayne Nobles. I represent Philip Dreyfus as well as the Public Defender's Office. I would like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal.
Certainly.
Counsel, Justices, this is a case where the state charged 13 total counts of sex assault and lewdness. And their case rested squarely on the shoulders of a complainant who had serious credibility issues. In fact, she had a documented history of lying. That came out in under oath through the complainant that she had actually made similar charges 4 years prior to this case and admitted under oath that she had lied about it. Additionally, you have her brother Alex, who testified under oath that not only does she lie, but she can lie to get out of trouble, she can lie to get someone else in trouble, and she had the capacity to lie about the instant allegations in this case. The
jury heard her testify, I presume?
Not as to the prior...
of course not. Fault. But nonetheless, this testimony was elicited that, she, in fact, she perhaps had some credibility issues. And the jury, apparently, given the disposition below, chose to find her credible.
I would say, Justice Day, they found her credible on two counts.
Okay.
Not on the other 11 not guilty counts. This is a case where any tiny little thing could have tilted the scales to either guilty or not guilty. Knowing that, the state took a shotgun approach in this case, basically loaded their shotgun with pellets of evidence, some of it improper, some of it involuntary, some of it hearsay, and just fired it out and see what kind of damage they could do. As Justice Seda recognized, they came back with two convictions, two life convictions. A couple of areas I wanted to focus on, one area being improper statements. Now, these were statements that were admitted and were, quite frankly, masquerading as bad acts. First one being the testimony about the pornography links. What you had was the brother testify that the family computer contained on there were links to pornographic sites. Well, first of all, there's a foundation problem. No one testified exactly if you actually click on those hyperlinks, they do, in fact, take you to a porn site. They could have taken someone to ESPN.com or Amazon.com. No one is sure. Secondly, who put them there? We don't know that. It's a family computer. Mr. Dreyfus had access to it. His two teenagers had access to it. Their friends, as well as a caretaker who was coming to the home to care for Mr. Phillips. Additionally, there was never any forensic evidence about this computer. The police never seized it, never did any kind of forensic examination to see if, in fact, there were pornographic images on there, child pornographic pictures. Also, where's the relevance? These pornographic links have no relevance concerning the charges Mr. Dreyfus is facing. Additionally, these were highly prejudicial. Basically, what the state was soliciting from these statements is, here's this man who goes surfing the internet for pornography, quite possibly child pornography. That prejudice far outweighs any kind of probative value that would have been gained from that. There's also another statement about dinner being thrown against the wall, and that was testified to by a counselor from the school who had heard that from the complainant. Again, more prejudicial than it is probative, has nothing to do with the charges, basically being introduced to show that he's an angry man, an angry porn-surfing man. There was a discussion about incest and some testimony about incest. Now, the incest topic may be related to the sex assault as well as the lewdness. However, the nature of the discussion was not admissible, and the trial court let that discussion in. Basically, what it was is a biblical discussion about Cain, Abel, and their mother somehow having a relationship to repopulate the earth. The nature of that discussion has nothing to do with the charges he was facing. Again, extremely, extremely prejudicial with no probative value. Lastly, under this general area is a statement about a cigarette run. Alex, the brother, got up and testified that Dad, which is Mr. Phillip, Mr. Dreyfus, sends me on cigarette runs to get used butts. I'm usually gone 30 to 45 minutes. No relevance to this case. The reason there's no relevance is because the complainant had previously testified that the touching that she alleges happened would only happen when Alex went to school and she was forced to stay home. She never mentioned anything about touching going on during these cigarette runs. So again, highly prejudicial, no probative. Another area that I want to focus on is hearsay and the bolstering statements that were allowed in. First off, Dr. Zabijan was called by the state, and he testified as to what his findings were. He actually made a legal conclusion, and here's his quote. If someone touches somebody in a genital area, even though they don't actually cause damage, it's still considered sexual assault. Inappropriate touching, sexual abuse. That is flat out a wrong statement of the law, number one. The correct statement of the law is under NRS 200-366, a person who subjects another person to sexual penetration or who forces another person to make a sexual penetration on himself, herself, or another person is guilty of sexual assault. Pursuant to Mukhtar versus California State University Hayward, experts are not allowed to give legal conclusions. That is strictly the purview of the jury. That is their job, not a legal, an expert's job. Another area that was, we believe, hearsay. The statement that Alex testified to when they were out jogging on this exercise regimen, it was revealed to him by the complainant that their dad had touched her inappropriately. That came in, and it shouldn't have. The reason it shouldn't have is under the Patterson test, it fails the third prong. And that third prong, justices, is the statement should have been made prior to the time that the complainant's motive to lie arose. Well, what we've got here is someone who's still in the middle of that motive. She doesn't like staying with her dad, which she testified to. She was out on this run. Her statement should have been made before any of that. But this statement was made during the regiment, the exercise regiment that was going on for months, and it was let in improperly. Additionally, what that statement did is help bolster the complainant's credibility. And at trial, she testified first, and she was cross-examined thoroughly about her credibility. Then they brought the brother on, and during cross-examination, they got the same statement out of the brother as they did from the sister. So what they're doing is they're backdooring to build up her credibility that's already been exposed on cross-examination when she herself was on the stand. Another area was the testimony of the CPS agent, Agent Tomasati. And what she basically did is got on there and said, look, this complainant gave a great story. It was filled with information and details and held herself out as an expert in these types of cases. So what she's doing is telling the jury, you really need to believe this girl because she gave so much information, so much detail, she can't be lying. That is improper under Townsend and Marvell. I also want to get to an area where we are using the word victim to describe the complainant in this instant matter. And that was done both by the trial court as well as the state. With the trial court, through the jury instructions, they listed her the victim, the victim, the victim. And those were in instructions 5, 14, and 19. Basically, what the trial court's doing is de facto suggesting to the jury, basically, you can take it as a fact that she's been found as a victim, because it's in the jury instructions that we tell you to follow. Additionally, you've got the state standing up in closing and saying she's a victim, 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 repeating it. What that's doing is taking away a little bit of their burden that they're held to, because by the trial court telling the jury, look, she's a victim through the jury instructions, they're basically taking away the state's responsibility and their burden by a little bit. Also want to get to the area of Mr. Dreyfus' statement that he gave to the police. What I want to focus on is, was it freely and voluntarily given? And there's certain totality of circumstance tests that we used. Factors like the age of the accused, the lack of education, the low intelligence, the lack of constitutional advisement, the length of the detention, and repeated and prolonged nature of the questioning. Well, applying those to this case, what you have is Mr. Dreyfus, who has only completed high school, doesn't have any type of advanced education, no college, no advanced degree. He has no prior experience with the criminal system. He's never been subject to any kind of questioning or criminal interrogations. And he's got some serious health ailments, including high cholesterol, heart issues, diabetes, seizures, depression, and pain management, which he is taking a bunch of medications for. Especially for the pain management, he is taking prescribed narcotics, Oxycontin and Percocet. And he was on those when he went down to be interrogated by the police. And you can tell the effect that it had on his mind, because at one point the detectives actually stop and say to him, "Mr. Phillips, are you okay? Can you still hear me? Are you still with us?" And then carry on with their interrogation. There were also some coercive tactics used by the detectives in this case. And when I say detectives, I'm talking about three detective justices. Not one, not two, all three of them participated in the interrogation of Mr. Phillips. And through their actions, basically what they did, I'm sorry, thank you, Justice Kim. Basically what they did through their actions is promised him, look, if you make some admissions, it's going to be a lot better on you. And they basically used the carrot and the stick. First, they tried to entice him with the carrot by making statements such as, the only way to help your daughter and get better counseling is to give a complete admission of guilt. That's page 157 of the appendix. Secondly, this is your opportunity to tell me it was just a one-time mistake, page 129. I can't pass on information about your son and daughter's schoolwork and what's going on in Nebraska if you don't talk to me. Page 160. Well, when that wasn't working, they then brought out the stick and they shook it threateningly at him with statements such as, if you're not going to respond, there's not much I can do to help you. That's page 160. Talk to me like a man or your next stop is the Clark County Detention Center. Page 162. So these coercive questioning is in violation of Bessie, as well as Blackburn and its progeny. These coercive tactics just taken by themselves are enough to make the statement involuntary. But when you take those as well as the totality of the circumstances, this statement or confession, whatever you want to call it, should not have been let in. I see my time is winding up.
3 minutes and 32 seconds.
Very quickly, this was a very, very close case. The state trusted a complainant who had severe credibility issues, documented credibility issues. By letting in all these different improper statements, voluntary statements, what they did is load up the shotgun and fired it off. That tilted the jury's persuasion towards a guilty conviction. And unless you have any questions, I'm going to reserve
just say this.
Well, I have a comment. You're saying that, admittedly, out of eight counts, you only two came back with guilty findings, and so therefore there must be some problem with the manner in which this trial was conducted. Isn't it correct that, in fact, your client's DNA was found at or near the breast area of the victim in this case?
That is correct, Justice Sata, but there was an explanation offered to that by our client. Specifically, it's basically a very small apartment they live in. He was known to drool. Alex did admit to that. So did the complainant. So
drooling over her breasts or what?
No, sir. Drooling on his pillow. Because they were in such close quarters, it is possible that maybe some of the DNA from the pillow could have gotten on there.
I see.
So there was testimony to that on how there could be DNA transference.
But it's also consistent with the statement that he made to the police, which you allege was coerced, correct?
That is correct.
We have 2 minutes and 28 seconds left. Mr. Steinhardt, on behalf of the state.
Thank you, Justice Cherry, Justice Gibbons, and Justice Nada. First of all, I think I'll go in reverse order here. Close case. I will admit that maybe on some of the earlier counts, there could have been a close case issue, especially in light of the fact that there was at least the allegation that she'd previously made a statement or made an accusation that had been recounted. And I need to make it clear as to what that accusation was. It was not sexual in nature as far as touching or her being involved in some sort of sexual liaison with him. It was the two prior instances that were discussed years before involved her supposedly watching pornography on a computer, which is germane to what follows later in the trial, as well as the fact that he, as punishment,
wanted her to dance on a phone book in her underwear. Those are the two allegations. Nothing about any touching, nothing about any sexual penetration or sexual act other than the pornography that he had her watch at one point. That being said, the close case issue. Moving to the last portion of the information in this case, we had two charges that the jury came back on, counts 12 and counts 13, both of which were lewdness with a minor child. Not sexual assault, but lewdness with a minor. None of the sexual assault charges were actually, did the jury find the defendant guilty of. In those two charges relate to a single event in which two separate assaults, or lewdness acts rather, took place. One being the licking of the breast, the other being the fondling of the genitalia. Those are the two charges that the jury came back with finding guilty. Now what's important about those and why it's not a close case with respect to those two counts alone is the fact that DNA evidence, his DNA was found around the nipple area of her breast. And there was testimony by the forensic examiner who came in, who did the work, said that essentially the entire profile was of the defendant. Now this is dried saliva on a breast the next day that is sampled, and then the only DNA that really comes back on it is the defendant's. That told the investigator, and that investigator testified to this before the jury, that she felt it was saliva because of that, because it's a rich source of DNA, and because of the location and the amount that was there, it clearly showed that it was saliva on the breast. That goes hand in hand with what Your Honor said earlier regarding his admission of that very act. When they asked him, he never really comes out and says that he does this, but they ask him repeatedly questions that any reasonable male individual should have an answer to. For example, and then you kissed her breast by placing your mouth on her breast. That's page 48. His response, possibly. His response throughout this entire process was, possibly. I don't remember. It could have happened. This is in questions being asked of him regarding his fingers on the genitalia, his fingers inside the vagina, his actually molesting his daughter. I submit to you, ladies and gentlemen, that in this particular instance, before the jury on those two counts, that it was not a close case. You have his own admissions. You have forensic evidence that is backed up by an investigator who testifies about that evidence. And there's no other perpetrator involved. There's no other individual involved with the saliva, and it's on her breast. Now, that being said, on those two counts, where you have not only DNA and you have his statements, you can take her statements completely out of the ballgame. And there's enough evidence there, more than enough, to convict. DNA, his saliva, should not be on her nipples, plain and simple. And the jury saw that. They convicted on those points. Because of the issues raised on the accounts, which dealt with these two prior accusations, that the jury did hear some testimony about her, that in fact there were some false allegations, that in fact she had recanted at one time. She was not recanting them at the time of trial. There were reasons that were proffered as to why that occurred, but suffice it to say that that was enough to put reasonable doubt into the minds of the jury as to other acts that took place, not the acts on the day after, or the day before she actually reported. There was no delay in reporting. The events happened that evening. The next morning, she reports to the authorities at the school, and then the police get involved, and sampling of her breast takes place. Right where she said it would be, his saliva. When they ask him, he doesn't have an answer for it. Now, beside that, the statement to the police, the judge watched this. This is not something where he was reading a cold, hard transcript. He actually watched the entirety of the video, as did the jury. The jury had that information. The judge had that in a hearing, in a Jackson Dental hearing prior to trial, made the finding based on that hearing. And beside that, the defendant himself took the stand prior to trial in the hearing and testified regarding the voluntariness issue. After all of that evidence came into play, the judge ruled that the statement was voluntary, and rightly so. Here are a couple of points. At the time that the statement was made, this defendant was supposedly on medication. The medications that he was on, by his own admission, the time period when the interview took place and the medications he was on was his most lucid period of the entire day, the time when he was the most awake, the time when he dealt with his children, when he played video games with him, when he, in fact, helped them with their homework. He was in the interview for over an hour, for about an hour and a half, a little short of that total. And after about an hour and 9 minutes, they start getting into the meat of the matter, where they start asking him some specific questions. It was only at that point that he became very vague in his answers, became very reserved, and became more quiet. And it was only after that time that the admissions came forward. His main concern during the questioning, from beginning to end, was what? Was, what information do you have on me? What evidence do you have against me? That's what he wanted to know. Why? What did she say? If that's what I did, if that's what she says I did, then I should go to jail. I should die. Those are some of the comments that he makes in his statement. Now, with all of that evidence, the state believes and submits to this court that the judge ruled in favor of the voluntariness of this case, meaning that his statement was voluntary and the evidence therefrom could come in, and it was rightly ruled upon. Now, as far as the victim reference, in this case, under NRS 217.070, subsection 3, it defines victim in the NRS as a minor who is sexually abused. That is what we have here. That is exactly the type of situation in which the term victim can be used, even in the statutes of Nevada. And this court has used that term in similar cases in its opinions repeatedly. With regard to the other issues that counsel raised, the improper statement, the pornography, things like that, those were raised by the defense as well in their opening, as well as later on. In the opening statement by counsel, a defense counsel, he listed 6 points that the jury would hear testimony about. Discipline, the issue of all of the things that took place regarding how he did his unique way of disciplining children. And again, that was different for the male versus the female child. Discipline, the sick dad, poverty, the exercise program, he raises that. Manipulation by the mother, and prior false accusations. He brings that in. What was the prior false accusation? It related to child pornography viewing. If you do not couple that accusation with the fact that he had her dance on a phone book in her underwear as punishment, because why? She had been on a trampoline, had gotten wet, her pants were wet, and he didn't want to punish her, at least this is what the evidence came out before the jury, because he knew that she would bruise. He disciplined the son, Alec, physically, but he did not discipline her. So he has her take off her clothes, except for her underwear and bra, and he has her dance on a phone book. She later recants that, in part because of the family strife that was going on and the fact that she needed to move back. The whole issue behind the case for the defense was the circumstances in this family, that she was trying to get away, and she made up everything to try and get away. The fact that she makes up everything to try to get away is part and parcel to what she actually said and what they were arguing she had done before, where she had made up something. They asked the questions of her brother, Alec, do you think your sister can lie? The answer was yes. Do you think she would lie to get her herself out of trouble? Yes. I submit to you that virtually any child, would potentially lie in a situation and to get themselves out of trouble. But in this particular instance, it rises to a different level. It's not whether or not you stole the cookie out of the cookie jar and don't need to go to stay out later than you should. This is sexual abuse of a child by her father. Now, those statements were certainly strategically, not only were they not objected to, but it was strategically a situation that we believe the state or the defense entered into to bring that evidence forth. They mention it in their opening statement. They mention it when they go over the cross-examination of both Selena and Alec, the direct of Dreyfus, and in their closing. It was replete throughout their entire case, and it was the basis of their entire case. So as far as that issue is concerned, I think that whether it be the cigarette runs or the pornography links or things like that, those were all part and parcel. The incest statement, that he had talked to them about incest in the past, was part and parcel to the sexualization of the child. In all of the instances in this case, when he had her, and I'm talking about the what I term the victim, Selena in this case, when he had her alone, And being alone was an important matter here. She had her own room. He did not. He was in the living room with the brother. When he had her alone, he did everything he could to try and stimulate her, to bring her into it by putting ice cubes on her breast, by doing various things that would touch when he was touching her to find out if she reacted to it. He was trying to sexualize her from the beginning, and the references to the pornography that he was on the computer that he had her view during the acts that were taking place that she testified about were to do the exact same thing, whether it be trying to titillate someone with an ice cube or titillate someone with a pornography site. It doesn't really matter. The end product is the same in this case, that she, in fact, was the subject of his desires at that point, that he engaged in this extreme exercise program so that she would remain in shape, so that she would stay desirable to him. Those were the basis for what he was doing. The issue with regard to Dr. Sabijan, he is an expert. He did not testify, as in Townsend, the case that I think counsel refers to, as to who committed the crime, or that, in fact, the child's testimony was true. He never mentions anything like that. He says, based on his experience, and his testimony went to this fact and this fact primarily, which was, is there evidence of sexual assault in all cases? Meaning that are there instances where the sexual assaults occurred, where penetration has occurred, where, in fact, there are no physical findings? His answer was yes. That's what he was questioned on repeatedly. His use of the word sexual assault was in the context of talking about penetrating and damage that would result in a finding. With regard to the shotgun approach of the evidence, ladies and gentlemen, the evidence was brought forth to the jury by the instances that the victim had recounted. The one instance in which there were two acts that this victim, in this case, was convicted or was had not only recounted the information pertaining to those acts, but we had backup information pertaining to admissions by the defendants regarding those specific acts, as well as DNA evidence supporting that as well. I go back to the DNA, ladies and gentlemen, as well as the saliva, as well as where it was located, when the disclosure took place. You put all of that together with his admissions and take her completely out of the ballgame, and that's what you could convict on. If the jury had reasonable doubt as to whatever reason there was for her recanting or replicating, they exercised that in the first counts in which there was no DNA evidence and no direct admission by the defendant. Those are the two counts that he's charged with. Those are the two counts that he was convicted of, and those are the two counts that he should remain convicted of. Now, as far as I think the one last point that I wanted to get out was, the great story issue. This was a single instance in which the CPS examiner said, in questioning about, how did the interview go? Was it a difficult interview? Did you have to mine the information out of her? Her response, a single response that was unobjected to, which was, she gave a great interview. She immediately, in the same sentence, basically defined what she meant, which was she gave a great interview, she gave good information or a lot of information and details. There was no objection, it was not redressed by the state, it was not asked again by the defense, and she never mentions it again. It's a single instance, and she defined it immediately after she said it. With regard to the hearsay statements, ladies and gentlemen, or justices, This is a situation where before that information came out from Alec, Selena had testified. And Selena had testified to excruciating detail about in cross-examination about her credibility. Her credibility was raised in opening. It was raised during her direct. It was raised with Alex. It was raised in closing. Her credibility was central and key to this entire case. And the fact that they raise it with the witness just before Alex, which was Selena, and raise it so strongly and make it sound like all of those statements that she made were recently fabricated. Clearly, the state believed opened the door to at least an inquiry along those lines, and the court ruled in favor as well. With that, Your Honor, your Justices, if you have any questions,
just say to just... Thank you, Mr. Sauter. You have about 2 minutes and 28 seconds for rebuttal.
Thank you, Justice Cherry. Counsel just mentioned in trying to explain the credibility problems the complainant had is, well, why would she come back to Las Vegas? Well, what was going on, Justices, is there was a custody battle. She went with Mom to Nebraska. And the reason she got to Nebraska is because she made up the allegations about Dad putting her on the phone book and dancing in her underwear and showing her pornography. That's how she got to go to Nebraska. When she got tired of Nebraska, she wants to come back to Las Vegas. The way she does that, let me recant what I said. That didn't really happen. And that's how she ends up in Las Vegas. Through her own words, she said Mr. Dreyfus was going to pay her to come here. So that's the whole reason she came back here. As you can see, huge credibility issues. Also, they mentioned that she was pretty quick in disclosing this to the counselor. Well, she was a habitual truant. She had missed school once again. How fortuitous to come up with this, well, my dad is abusing me, that's why I missed school, versus, you know what, I just ditched again and I'm truant. She had a chance to concoct that so she can get out of trouble for being a habitual truant at the school.
I understand that. I guess my biggest problem is how can she concoct his saliva on her breast, and when the DNA tests were done, you know, there wasn't a mix of DNA, it was all his. It's pretty hard. I mean, I think it couldn't a rational jury conclude beyond a reasonable doubt that he's guilty, at least of that particular offense?
Justice Gibbons, somewhat, especially when you consider the testimony from Mr. Dreyfus himself, how he drools, it's usually on his pillow. It is not out of the realm of possibility, which was part of our defense, that she could have easily grabbed the pillow and rubbed it on there so she can have an even stronger assertion that this was going on. Keep in mind, Justice Gibbons, she had tried this earlier, as I had explained to the panel, and going from Vegas to Nebraska. Didn't want to stay here anymore, concocted this story, realized she got caught, and now she understands, I've got to do something a little more serious, a little more extreme, if you will.
Okay.
Counsel brought up the statement and basically said that Mr. Dreyfus was vague in his answers. Well, when someone is telling you you've committed probably one of the worst crimes we have here, touching your own daughter, and he's on the medications, as I pointed out, as well as the prescription drugs. Of course he's going to be like, well, what did I do? And just very briefly, if I understand counsel, he's basically conceding he was on all these mind-altering drugs, but yet the statement was okay because at one of his most lucid moments, that's when this supposed confession came out.
Well, thank you to both lawyers in this matter. You certainly both were prepared for this argument. And this panel certainly appreciates your argument.
Justice Cherry, can I make a statement to
sure.
the attorneys? You know, I we appreciate Justice Cherry scheduling our arguments in Las Vegas at times. Most of them are in Carson City. I know Ms. Lemke's appeared before us many, many times, you know, like that. Mr. Nobles, this is the first time at least you've appeared in front of me, and Mr. Stoddard as well. I thought you were excellent. I just want to tell you that. I think your demeanor is excellent for both of you. Your arguments were straightforward and make it much easier to us to follow and analyze it. So I hope you can both appear in front of us a lot in the future.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. This case will stand submitted, and we'll be in recess.